This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.
Welcome to yet another episode of Taiwan Bound. I'm Ido Aharoni, your host, and today it is my distinct pleasure to host in our studio Professor Israel Hershkovitz.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Yes, welcome to our show. And to our viewers and listeners, I will say that he's a professor emeritus of anatomy and anthropology in the School of Health Professions, which is part of the Faculty of Medicine at Tel Aviv University. He's a veteran of the university, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. My first question to you would be, Professor Hershkovitz, tell us what's the difference between, because a lot of people hear anthropology and they think of, you know, this romantic researcher somewhere in Africa researching tribes, the Bushmen and all that. But you are referring to a different kind of anthropology, right?
Yes, so my profession is physical anthropology. It refers to the biological aspect of human beings. And actually, I was caught by the romantic appealing of social anthropology, and I started my career at the Hebrew University studying psychology and social anthropology. Only during my master's degree, I realized that I'm more interested in actual facts and measuring people and looking at people and physical characteristic of people rather than on their social and cultural backgrounds. And so I switched from the social science to the medical sciences.
Which is a very unusual transition, I must say. I studied social anthropology in this university in the 1980s. And before we started the recording, I told you that I remember that as a social anthropology student, we were given a book about physical anthropology that was written about Lucy, which we both agreed that is the most famous human fossil in history. And you mentioned that not necessarily rightly so, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, when Lucy was discovered more than 40 years ago, people thought that Lucy is on the way to human to Homo, to our species. So it caught a lot of interest and attention of the world, basically. Now, after more than 45 years of research, we know that Lucy belongs to a certain section of hominids that are not related directly to our species. So the glory of Lucy reduced in time.
And I read somewhere that you said in an interview that our particular location here in the Middle East, that part of the world, is a very unique location in terms of human migration and the history of human migration, which affects greatly your area of physical anthropology. Can you tell us a little bit about how and why?
Well, first of all, what you have to realize is that people were moving all the time, people migrating from one place to another. If we all agree that the origin of Homo is somewhere in Africa 3 million years ago, basically, so people start in a certain period of time, start migrating out of Africa and later on even from Eurasia to Africa, back to Africa. So they had to cross some kind of a bridge, a land bridge between Africa and Eurasia. And the only land bridge that exists is actually our region, what we call the Levant. It's quite a narrow bridge of land that connect both giant continents. So all the people that were migrating from Africa to Eurasia had to pass in certain period of time through Israel, through the Levant, through Israel, Lebanon, Syria. Basically, this is why Israel is one of the most richest places in the world with Homo fossils.
Now, in your work of trying to discover the remains of the human fossils, I'm assuming you're working with archaeologists.
Well, we are not excavating ourselves. We are taking part in excavating caves and open air sites. But basically, the people who are conducting the excavation, most of the field work, are archaeologists or prehistorians.
So you get to examine and analyze their findings. What tools do you have for that process?
Well, what you have to realize, though, is that the bones or the skeleton is a huge recording machine in our body. It records every event in human life. So when you have bones or you start studying a fossil, you can actually gain information on demographic aspect like the sex and age of the individual, on the physical characteristic, the height and the weight, and then the appearance of the individual, his medical history, whether he was exposed to violent or to trauma of some kind. Even if you can even gather information about his genes, you can gain information about the local environment, you can get a lot of information about the individuals. So basically what physical anthropologists are doing is building what we call the biological and social profile of the fossils. Once you get a full profile of the fossil, if you have many fossils, then you can gain information, important information about the population itself. You can get into issues of social structures, division of labors, and many other interesting aspects of not just of biological aspect, but even of social aspect of human populations.
And how far can we go back doing that in terms of the timetable? So you mentioned our type of species emerged some 3 million years ago in Africa.
Well, our species appeared somewhere 500,000 years ago, but our close relatives appeared on Earth around 3 million years ago.
And when you were talking about findings, human fossils that were discovered and excavated in our part of the world, how far do we go back?
In Israel?
Yeah.
In Israel, it's around 2 million, 1.5. The oldest site, known site in Israel is called Ubadia. It's located south of the Sea of Galilee. It's roughly dated to 1.5 million. But we know that people will start migrating out of Africa, what we call Homo erectus, start migrating out of Africa around 2 million years ago. So probably we expect to find older site in Israel than Ubadia site. But for the time being, this is the oldest site, prehistoric site in Israel.
And when you think about the skill set that you were able to develop over the years, and when you think about the task that Israeli law enforcement and military are facing these days as a result of October 7, where does that meet you?
Well, we do the same work that we do with fossils, we do with the victims of the October the 7th. More or less, because what we are sometimes, you know, most of the identification today is carried out by DNA analysis. But sometimes DNA analysis is useless in the sense that the bodies are burned so heavy that you can't extract DNA neither from the soft tissue nor from the bones. So you have to rely solely on the bones. And usually the bones or what remains from the skeletons are very fragmentary. So what we do basically, we collect sometimes hundreds of small pieces of bone, glue them together, it's like a huge puzzle, put the bones together, and then try to reconstruct the biological profile of the victim, of the individual. And then when we have the biological profile, we start comparing it to missing people and try to find the best matching.
And have you had success doing that since October 7th?
Yes, we managed to identify several victims. Sometimes the identification relies solely on anthropological studies. I mean, there are no other hints to the identity of the victim. Sometimes we get partial support from DNA. For example, in one case that I was involved in, the DNA analysis could tell that the victim is a female. And I, from the anthropological study, could tell that it's a young girl around 12 years of age. And then combining the genetic data with the anthropological data, with the circumstances of the finding, you can get quite a good identification of the victim.
So in this case, you were able to identify a 12-year-old girl that otherwise we could have not identified her.
Exactly.
That's quite remarkable. That's quite remarkable. And all this work is being done. Tell us a bit about the system that is carrying out this important work.
Well, there are two institutions in Israel that are directly involved in identification. One is the Forensic Institute that I was volunteering and working there for 2 months, and then the Army, which I was helping the Army for a month, roughly a month or so. So the army do the identification of the soldiers only, and the civilians are done by the Institute of Forensic Medicine at Abu Kabir.
And when you, I'm assuming that you had other colleagues working in this area. How many people would you say we have in Israel today that have that kind of expertise that you have?
Well, there are not too many anthropologists in Israel.
I'm assuming
physical anthropologists, maybe there are a lot of social anthropologists, but physical anthropologists, people who are involved directly with studying bones, either recent bones or ancient bones, are very few, less than 10.
Now, are you using any... So tell us about the process. I'm very curious about the process. Does it involve any chemical testing, or what kind of tools you're using in the process of examining the human fossil?
Well, first of all, we have what we call... we study the morphology of the bones. The morphology of the bone tell us a lot about, give us a lot of information, for example, about specific exercise or physical stress that the individual was exposed to. We studied pathological signs on the bone, because you can even reconstruct the health history of the individual by actually studying some lesions on the bones, which contains a lot of information about past diseases or past illness of the individuals. So on top of it, you can use DNA analysis if you manage to extract DNA from the bones. In Israel, for example, you can extract DNA from bones that are older, not older than 15,000 years ago. So, but most of our fossils are older than that. We can do some isotope analysis, which gives us information about diet and the environment, the local environment that the people are living in. So it's a combination of methods. Those are what we call traditional methods, which are based on naked eye observations, and sophisticated methods like extracting DNA analysis or running out isotope analysis. You combine the data from different sources in order to build a reliable and valid picture of the individual.
Now, I'm assuming that post 9/11 in New York, a similar effort was required. Were you at all in the picture of what happened there?
Yeah, partially, because what you have to realize that the Americans were not able to identify individually most of the victims in 9/11.
Because they were completely burned.
They were completely burned, so they keep much of the bone, they keep in a certain place in order, with the hope that one day the technology will be sophisticated and advanced enough to extract the necessary data in order to identify the victims. So most of the victims were not identified on the individual level as we do in Israel. In Israel, it's a different story, because we fight for every individual. We don't accept the notion of people being missing. We have, you know, Ron Arad, we have one missing person in our history, and we still talk about him justifyingly. And we said to ourselves when we started the process of identifying, not just myself, but many people were involved in identifying the victims of October the 7th, but we said to ourselves, we will not have missing individuals, either soldiers or civilians, doesn't matter. We'll do the utmost, every effort needed, every effort required in order to identify all the people. And it was a huge effort, and for the time being, we don't have any missing individuals now.
That's incredible. And again, you know, as I'm sure I'm speaking on behalf of all the viewers and the listeners and the community of our university, when I express gratitude to you and to your colleagues for what you're doing, it is remarkable.
It's not, as I said, it's not to me personally, because it's a lot of people involved, geneticists and other people, medical doctors, forensic doctors, you know, anthropologists, who were all involved in working together, hands in hand, in order to identify the victims.
Now, you mentioned some possible technological advancements looking into the future. What would you say should we all expect when it comes to technological breakthroughs in your field of physical anthropology?
Well, first of all, our biggest hope is to be able to extend the DNA analysis. I mean, DNA analysis is limited in our region, what you call hot regions, to 15,000 years, which covers a very minor part of human evolution. Imagine to yourself the human evolution span over like 3 million years ago, and I can extract DNA not older than 15,000 years ago. It's a big limitation. So most of our paleo-identification, my ability to identify different Homo species that are older than 15,000 years ago, are very limited and are based mainly on morphological observations. So I hope that the future technology will allow us to extend it to 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 years ago, back in 300 years back in time.
And that is dependent upon what? Is it what is required is more machine learning, more powerful computers for analysis, or what is it that is missing in order for that to happen?
It's the amount of mainly the amount of DNA that you can work with. I mean, it's we need less and less amount of DNA in order to extract to build a DNA profile of the individual. So my hope is with time we will be able to extract enough DNA or to use minute amount of DNA in order to build the biological history of the fossil.
And beyond that, what else do you think can happen technologically that will advance the field of physical anthropology?
Isotope analysis is doing a major step forward. There were many problems in the past with isotope analysis because you can it's a long story, but basically isotope can give you a lot of information on diet, for example, what people were eating in the past. It gives you information about the environment, whether people were living in cold or warm environment, and many other aspects of human life. And we are getting better and better in that respect as well, but we hope to make a much bigger advance in the near future.
Now, you were specifically involved in the discovery and the studying of one particular human fossil that was discovered in the area of Ramla, I think the name
Neshe
Ramla. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, before telling about Neshe Ramla, what people should realize, I mean, today we are the only species on Earth, Homo sapiens. But people are not realizing that 200,000 years or 300,000 years ago, there were many Homo species on Earth. We were not alone. We were sharing the globe with other Homo species. So imagine to yourself that you wake up in the morning and you see other people that are similar to you but are not the same as you are, and we managed to live next to the other for hundreds of thousands of years. For some reason that we are not aware of, we are not sure about, 50,000 years ago, all the other Homo species disappeared. And we live alone. For the last 50,000 years, we are the only species living species on Earth. But I was interested in the time before 50,000 years ago. What was going on here in the Levant? What I call the central bus station of human evolution, because people were coming and going through the Levant, as I mentioned before. It's a land bridge between continents, so people were passing through all the times. So I was interested in understanding what kind of interaction this kind of different people had at that time. And Neshe Ramla, one of the Homo species that I identified in Israel, looked more like a Neanderthal than Homo sapiens, and managed to live. Those are actually the indigenous people of the Levant way before the Homo sapiens arrived to the region, because Homo sapiens arrived to the Levant roughly 250,000 years ago. But people were living here in the Levant, in Israel, before 250,000 years ago. So Neshe Ramla are actually the indigenous, the local people before the arrival of Homo sapiens. And imagine to yourself, one day they came out of the cave and see other people coming out of Africa, and those are the Homo sapiens, and they start to interact and exchange knowledge. And you see the change in literature, in human behavior, in many aspects of human life that actually are the result of this interaction between two different Homo species.
Now, what kind of interaction they had? The was it based on developing social skills together? For example, you know, getting food together, or what kind of interaction they developed?
We don't know. What we know for is that the local people, the indigenous people, very quickly adapted the type of tools that were used by Homo sapiens that were much more advanced than the local lithic industry. If before the arrival of Homo sapiens, local people used mainly some kind of hand axe and scrapers, when Homo sapiens came with a totally new innovation, new type of tools, they were quickly adapted by the local population because they were much more advanced. As local people, for example, are riding horses and then a car is coming to the region, so slowly, very quickly replace the horses with cars. Same happened 200,000 years ago in Israel, where the local people quickly understood the advantage of the newcomers, the new culture, and very quickly adapted it. But this is on the social level, on exchanging knowledge. But what we know more than that they were exchanging genes. Before we start to find hybrids along the fossil records in Israel, and some of the population doesn't look neither like Homo sapiens nor like pre-Neanderthal. They look somewhere different, which suggests that those are some kind of hybrid population between the indigenous local people and the newcomers, the Homo sapiens.
And that was probably one of the explanations, I think, that you mentioned before, that we're not sure why our kind of species managed to survive, and all the other types of species disappeared. I'm assuming this is one of the explanations, adaptability.
Probably. We don't know. There are many speculation why we are the only species today, living today on the globe. Either it has to do with our character, but I'm not sure about it, because the evidence suggests that we were living side by side in peace with some pre-Neanderthal populations in Israel. So if we managed to live for 100,000 years, for more than 100 years together, what happened in a certain period of time that the local indigenous population disappeared? Either they were assimilated, because of small numbers, they were assimilated into the new population, newcomers, the Homo sapiens, or something else happened and that caused the disappearance of all the other, or of all the rest of Homo species on the globe. We don't know. It's one of the greatest mysteries of human evolution.
Yes, and of course that this whole thing ties into the concept of anti-fragility, which is a book right. I happen to read right now, that actually writes a lot about bones, about how humans are actually designed to be anti-fragile. We become stronger when we're faced with challenge. As Nietzsche said, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think that in your area it's probably well demonstrated, when you look at the way bones behave when they're facing pressure and trauma.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, before we conclude this conversation, because we're running out of time, so how do you envision the future of your field? So you mentioned a couple of possible technological breakthroughs that will allow us to be able to go back 300,000 years to analyze and learn from human fossils. But how would you describe the future of your field going forward?
I don't know.
It's a too broad of a question.
It's a too broad of a question. I know what's the biggest question on the table is that, as I said before, why we remained alone on the globe. I mean, reduced from more than 10 different Homo species 200 or 300,000 years ago to a single species 50,000 years ago. What happened to the way? If we will find the reason, maybe we'll learn to know how to treat other people or different people than we do today, because learning to know to treat the different is an important issue in human behavior. And somehow we managed to do that in the past, and it stopped in a certain period of time, and all our relatives disappeared. What happened to them? Why they disappeared? And why we remained alone? I think it's the central issue in human evolution today and in the near future.
And we do know that, you know, humans always engaged in war throughout history. Yet at one point, they became social beings, and they started collaborating with each other, which makes them very different. There are not too many organisms in nature that know how to do that. There are very few.
But what you have to realize is that there was many migration out of Africa. I mean, Homo sapiens start to migrate out of Africa like 250,000 years ago. But the big migration out of Africa occurred somewhere around 70,000 years ago, only 70,000 years ago. And this is a breaking line in the sense that from there onward, all the other species very quickly disappeared. We are all present-day population actually belong to that later migration out of Africa. We don't belong to the early migration out of Africa, to the 250,000 years or 100,000 years ago migration out of Africa. We are all the descendant of one big migration out of Africa 70,000 years ago. There was something that in that specific group that caused a dramatic change in human population globally. And the outcome was that we were left alone as the only single species on the globe.
Incredible. Well, Professor Heshkovitz, let me thank you on behalf of all of us here for what you and your colleagues are doing and for really giving us the perspective. It's kind of reassuring to listen to you because when you describe history in such a perspective, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, you know, it puts things in perspective. Even the most difficult days you can handle when you understand the big picture, the historical picture. So thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure, Ido, being with you today.
And hopefully we'll get a chance to host you again here under better circumstances.
Thank you.
To our viewers and listeners back home, this is it for today. Hope to see you during our next episode of Taiwan Bound. Goodbye from Tel Aviv.